Israeli rescue workers search through the rubble in Surfside. Hello and welcome to Sundial. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. On the ground in Surfside, a group from Israel is helping first responders look for people. We spoke to a colonel who's on the ground at the site and dealing with the heavy emotions there.
You see that the building is collapsing into itself. I didn't see a scene like this in my life.
Plus, vaccination rates in Florida are dragging, while cases are rising, especially among kids. We talked to an infectious disease expert about the next phase of the pandemic we're still in. But first, an update on the assassination of Haiti's president. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Haitians and the diaspora in South Florida woke up to shocking news. President Jovenel Moïse has been assassinated. Haitian interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph announced that a style attack on the president's home compound began around 1 this morning and ended with the president being mortally wounded. Moïse's wife, Martine Moïse, was also shot in their home in Port-au-Prince and is now hospitalized. Haiti is under a state of emergency. WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett has been following the updates all morning, and he joins us now with more details. Tim, we know that Haiti was experiencing intense levels of economic and political instability. Do we have any idea who may be behind this attack?
Not yet, unfortunately. There's been a lot of speculation because of a video that was released, purportedly taken by neighbors close to President Moïse's home there in his neighborhood in the hills above Port-au-Prince. This video showed a very commando style, as you said, operation of a group of men, heavily armed, who were apparently speaking either English or Spanish, and even identified themselves in a bizarre fashion as DEA, meaning U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, on some sort of raid. So there's a lot of speculation because of that this might have been a very professional, even international group of hitmen hired to do this, or it might have been local terrorists, because as we know, unfortunately, street gang violence, organized gang violence in Haiti has been rampant and highly severe in the past year or so in Haiti. But unfortunately, no, at this point, we really don't know who was behind this.
Well, you had the opportunity to speak with the president back in 2016 while he was visiting FIU, and the conversation focused on the country's constitutional crisis.
We are working hard, but I'm very worried. It's very important to have a constitutional government to start working to face this situation and grow food.
How would you describe the president and his mission for Haiti versus what happened in the country in reality?
Well, if you listen to that clip, he talks about how important it was to restore, as he said, constitutional governance in Haiti at a time when there was, as we said, a constitutional crisis. There was no real president at that time. It was hoped that when he came in as president, he would begin to restore that. But unfortunately, his presidency will be known more, sadly and ironically, for how he undermined constitutional governance in many ways in Haiti. He's been, up to the time of his assassination, he was ruling by decree for more than a year, and his critics said that he had blocked the holding of parliamentary elections in Haiti for more than a year. He had taken on a very sort of authoritarian style of governance in his presidency, and that unfortunately will most likely be his legacy.
Well, and how is the interim Prime Minister, Claude Joseph, responding to concerns about the safety of political leadership at this time?
Well, Prime Minister Joseph said this morning that the government has the situation under control. I don't think you'll find one Haitian on the streets who will believe that. Unfortunately, this heinous act that took place at about 1 o'clock in the morning as they stormed the president's house, this act only underscores how unstable and how unsecure Haiti is at this time, and how the rule of law has really just deteriorated severely under President Moïse. And so I think most Haitians right now are just see this as sort of a culmination of this violent crime crisis they've been living for so many months, and they feel that perhaps even worse is to come now.
When we should note, and you started to describe this style of leadership, but Moïse was not a popular president prior to his assassination. How is the diaspora responding to this tragedy?
Well, they're very shaken up as well, because many of them have obviously still have family, friends, loved ones there in Haiti who themselves have been experiencing all this violent crime, whether it's the street gang warfare in Port-au-Prince or the terrible ransom kidnapping wave that's terrorized the country for more than a year. And many in the diaspora themselves, when they have visited Haiti, there was just a case just before Christmas of a minister here and his daughter who were visiting their mission in Haiti, and they were kidnapped on Christmas Eve. Fortunately, were released later. But the diaspora here has been experiencing firsthand what has been happening there, and so they're very shaken by this as well.
Haitian Americans have been critical of the Biden administration's lack of a response to the ongoing violence in Haiti. Could this attack precipitate more involvement from the U.S. government?
I think it may, because now we're back to this very unstable situation of an interim government. And the Biden administration had allowed Moïse to continue in his presidency for a year longer than what his critics said the Constitution allowed him to do. And the Biden administration did that, indulged him on that, because they simply wanted to preserve stability until a new election could be held in the fall. There are doubts now that such an election will be held at all in the fall. And I think you're going to see the Biden administration really step up its involvement in the country to make sure that election is held and to restore some stability. Badly, desperately needed stability to Haiti.
I've been speaking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Pagent. We'll have further updates on the assassination of Haiti's president on All Things Considered today and on tomorrow's program. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Turning now to the latest from the Surfside condo collapse, officials announced this morning that at least 46 people have been found dead. 94 people are still unaccounted for. 10 people were uncovered in the rubble since yesterday. Rescue teams helping search for people in the aftermath have come from all over the world. Engineers, rescue specialists, and even docs have been sent in to help the efforts. That includes a team with the Israeli Defense Forces, and they've also assisted after other tragedies and international disasters, particularly earthquakes. Colonel Elad Edri is the deputy commander of that team. We spoke with him earlier today from the Surfside site. Colonel, how have search and rescue efforts changed since the demolition of the remaining south condo tower?
First of all, the demolition gave us the opportunity to get close and to search in areas that were forbidden. They were forbidden because of safety measures. This is the part where we believe that we will find between 25 to 30 trapped that are missing. And this is the first, let's say, benefit. And the second is that we have already found several trapped, unfortunately deceased. And we've been able to bring them to their families.
And Colonel, you mentioned you can feel the motivation, smell the motivation in the air at the scene. What is keeping you and the rest of your rescue team hopeful? What's motivating you?
One thing, the families. In the Israeli delegation, there is a division of, we divide the positions between me and the commander. The commander of the Israeli delegation, Colonel Golan, is in charge of the rescuers, the Israeli rescuers on site, and the engineers, the expert engineers. And my position is to be with the families. So we know that nearby us, there are dozens of family members and friends and their relatives that are waiting in every moment for the news that we found the beloved ones. And when we start a new shift, when we brief the rescue teams, all that we care is to bring them the news and give them the twist they need.
You mentioned part of your day-to-day job is with victims' families. What conversations are you having with them? How have they been involved in this process?
Twice a day, we brief them. We try to share with them all the information we can that they won't offend them by look at the pictures. But on the contrary, we want them to be filled in and feel part of the process. I think that the most important thing that we achieved to do with the families for the, let's say, first 4 or 5 days, that we put them in a position that they felt like they are a part of the rescue team, part of the effort. And how did we do it? We questioned them. We questioned them not like an investigation. We questioned them in a way that they were be able to give us as much as information as they can about their relatives. And when my officers questioned them and got the information from the family members, from neighbors, from relatives, from friends, we'd be able to have the full map of the building. We needed to map 12 floors. In each floor, there are 12 apartments. You can do the math.
I know your team has been involved in rescue and recovery operations after the earthquake in Haiti and other natural disasters. Were you personally involved in those missions? I'm wondering how this situation in Surfside is different or similar for you.
I was in Mexico in 2017 and in Nepal in 2015. And yes, we bring a lot of experience from these operations. But here, that operation is very unique. It's very unusual because in all my professional life, I haven't seen such a complex building like this one. It's so complicated. In earthquakes, I've been into 2 earthquakes. And then you see that the buildings, they turn to the side. They fell on the side. It's very rare to see a building that is collapsing inside itself. I didn't see it in my whole life. You see it only when you want to explode something. And actually, when they decided to bring down the remain building, you see how it collapsed into itself, but it was planned. And here, without planning, you see that the building is collapsing into itself.
Well, does your team know, is there a timeline for when efforts in Surfside transition from search and rescue over to recovery?
Not yet, but let's say that when we got to our attitude is that all trapped are alive. Of course, that after 13 days, it's almost zero chances. And I say it to the families every day. We don't lie, we don't hide it from them. Declaring between the face of search and rescue to the face of recovery, it's only by the power of this of the local government of Florida or the county mayor.
I'm speaking with Colonel Elad Edri. He's the deputy commander of the Israeli team that has been involved in search and rescue efforts at the Surfside site where the condo collapsed nearly 2 weeks ago. Search teams working on the site have come from all over the country and the world to help. You can find more of the latest on the Surfside tragedy on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, and how many people are in your rescue team that's here in Miami? I understand it's not only physics, engineering experts, and the rescue specialists, but also trauma therapy specialists.
We brought from Israel 3 officers that are specialists in 2 areas. One is population intelligence, which means that they know how to gather all the information we need from civil sources, such as the families that mentioned and the social media. Second part of their occupation, of their expertise, is to provide mental help for the rescue teams because they see hard pictures every day. and they experience very hard visions, experiences during the rescue operation. So twice a day, morning and evening, we have a close conversation of all the delegation members. And as I see on the pile, the other organizations, they do the same method. And we talk about what we see, what we saw, what we smelled, how do we feel, what we experienced. Each and one of the members is sharing one or two special moments they had on the pile. For example, 3 days ago, I participated in an action that we exposed the body. And I shared with my team members that there was a moment, you know, it hit me in one moment that how fragile can life be? Because I found a man in his bed, covered with his blanket. And, you know, I worked and I worked and I, you know, I operate my arms, and I don't think. And suddenly it hit me that I just stood up, looking at the body, and I thought to myself, it's such a cruel fate. I mean, the man went to sleep. That's it. We do it every day. Since the day we are born, we go to sleep. That's it. He didn't go to, you know, something dangerous. People do all these extreme sports. The guy just went to sleep. That's it. He naturally expected to get up in the morning and, I don't know, go to work or do other common things that all of us do. But he didn't get the chance to get there. So it hit me. And I felt for a couple of hours very, you know, with myself, very emotional. So I shared this moment with my friends. And all the members of the delegation, they do the same thing every day, twice a day. And this is how we cope with these very hard pictures that and visions that we see every day.
It's unimaginable. Thank you for sharing what you're seeing there. It's just incredibly difficult to talk about. What does it mean for you to be doing this work, given the personal struggles you just described?
Well, I think that the house, my home, the family that raised me, and the Israeli society really believes in a principle that we can't stand aside when other country, other nation is in need, is in emergency. And whenever and wherever we can contribute, and to help and to share our lessons and knowledge, because you have to understand that Israel sent delegations just like this one ever since 1985. I think this is the 22 or the 23 delegation. And we really believe that the state of Israel should help any nation that need our help. So it affects also the way that we are as individuals. We see that the mission that we represent our country, and we see it as a great honor. And I can't say that we are happy to be here, but, you know, we feel very blessed to have the opportunity to help and to represent our country.
Something that has stood out about this story has been the large Jewish community in Surfside that was affected by this tragedy. Have you been working with religious leaders, Jewish or otherwise, to consider religious sensitivities as you do this work?
Yes, of course. When we get out of Israel on Saturday, almost 2 weeks ago, we didn't think about the Jewish community or any other specific community. We came to save lives. It's not a slogan. It is the truth. These are the values of the state of Israel, to send delegation to save lives. That's it. Naturally, when we met here the Jewish community, which is very a large one, very warm community, welcomed us well. It was easy for us to connect with them, to to stick with them because we share the same religion, but that's it. And of course, we talked with rabbis and we talked with the leaders of the community, but we talked with all the leaders for all the communities we met here. And we tried to be very, comprehensive to all of them. And we tried to do our best in order to give them the comfort they need, because the situation is very rough for them. And I think that our presence here helps them to keep and going on from day to day.
What are the plans for your team going into the future here at Surfside? Do you have a projected departure date back to Israel?
Our main goal from now, from yesterday actually until Sunday, we tend to go back to Israel in Sunday after completing 15 days on a mission, on their mission. And our main goal is to hand on our knowledge, lessons, even technologies to FEMA and to other emergency organizations here. We meet everyone, the fire department, the police, the task force one, task force two. And we believe that they'll, from the point we leave, they will keep on going with the good actions until the mission is accomplished.
That was Colonel Elad Edri. He's the deputy commander of the Israeli team that has been involved in the search and rescue efforts in Surfside. He joined us from the site of the collapse earlier today. Still to come, ultra-high-performance concrete and how it could be used in condominiums in the future. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Swetelski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A new task force has been formed by the Florida Bar Association to investigate condominium law and provide recommendations for changes to Governor Ron DeSantis. Part of their investigation will include the construction and maintenance of condo buildings. Many, like the Champlain Towers, were built decades ago. Forensic engineers from the National Institutes of Standards and Technology remain at the site of the collapse, examining what may have been the root cause for the catastrophe. Adarad Azizi Namini is the director of the Moss School of Construction, Infrastructure, and Sustainability at FIU. He's working with a team of engineers conducting a study and detailed analysis of the tower. Adarad, tomorrow marks 2 weeks since the Champlain South Tower collapsed. Forensic engineers are looking closely at the first and second floors of the tower below the pool deck as possible areas where the collapse may have started. In your estimation, what may have contributed to the cracking in the foundation?
First of all, I believe it's too early to jump into conclusion, but certainly, I mean, we have seen more information. For example, there has been a report that the amount of the reinforcement connecting the slab to the column were not sufficient from the photos, which is the reinforcement around the column. That by itself, I don't believe that triggered the collapse. That certainly contributed. But to me, it seems like something with the column pulling down due to the maybe foundation, that could be one factor. But again, I mean, these are the issues that the inspectors, I'm pretty sure, they're looking at. But one thing that caught my eyes was that the foundation system used was kind of isolated, so they were not all connected together. So when you have the foundation that is not completely tied together with a grade beam or mat foundation or some another system, you can have a differential settlement. And the differential settlement usually is not a good thing for the building performance. But again, these are all speculations. I think we are conducting right now using the public information that's available, the plans that are available from the city. We are modeling the building, and in probably within a couple of weeks, hopefully we should be able to simulate different scenarios, like, for example, one column settling down or two columns settling down or other scenarios, and trying to see that what scenario could be contributing to this collapse. But more importantly, our study is more geared toward to see what changes we need to incorporate in our building codes.
Yes, and we'll get to that in just a minute here. But I want to focus on the 2018 report released by Morabito Consultants. That report found major structural damage in the concrete slab below the pool deck. And you make a good point that right now it is still speculative, but I think engineers now, there's a lot more information we have to look at and start seeing what factors could have led to this than there were 2 weeks ago. How do you think the degradation of the concrete over the past 3 years since this 2018 report could have ultimately led to the entire building's failure?
I think what's important is that the report in 2018, it does have photos and has pictures of the concrete cover spalling and corrosion. I think what's important, we need to, during the inspection, we need to spend some time and trying to see what the cause of those cracking is. Now, I don't believe anybody knows what were the causes of those. Another way, was it a support settlement? Was it just a concrete cracking and then the salt water intruding into the column and causing a corrosion? That we don't know. So just the fact that you have a cracking or you observe some corrosion, that by itself really is not a major factor. I mean, we know that. I mean, there's in the environment that we are in, I mean, you're going to have some corrosion. I mean, the balconies, for example, we know that, right? The balconies are prone to because of the concrete cover and other issues. So that by itself, that report by itself, at least to me, doesn't really identify the cause of it. And that's what's really important right now, trying to see that what were the cause of all those distress that we are seeing.
Yeah. And the building was constructed 40 years ago. Can you help us understand what the building and construction codes were like at the time? How are they different from today?
One thing that is different that we know, in 19, the American Concrete Institute in 1977, and I think the design drawings does refer to 1972, it should be 1971 or 1977, refer to that. In 1977, when you had a flat slab, the type of the construction that was used here, the bottom reinforcement in the slab was not continuous over the column. And I think the assumption at the time was that the type of the loading that the slab would be subjected to would always place the bottom of the slab in compression. Whereas in this case, I think one scenario that the investigator hopefully will take a look at, if the column, let's say for some reason, because of foundation or whatever, pulled down, imagine the pulling the column down, that puts the bottom of the slab into a tension. And that, if you don't have the reinforcement, concrete is not good in tension. That's why I think, in fact, that was reported in some news media that there was not enough reinforcement. Well, yes, there was not enough reinforcement, but from the picture, first of all, there is no corrosion. I didn't see any corrosion activity. And second of all, this building stood up 40 years. So if that was the trigger for the collapse, should have collapsed much earlier. So it wasn't the trigger. It contributed, certainly. It didn't have the redundancy. So I think at the time, the code of the time did not require the reinforcement in the bottom of the slab to go around the column. But later in the 90s, I think that changed. Now you have to continue the reinforcement. So that was the one difference.
I'm speaking with Adarad Azizi Namini, director of the Moss School of Construction, Infrastructure, and Sustainability at FIU. We're examining the possible causes of the Surfside condo collapse and how building construction may be approached differently as a result. You can find more of our reporting on the Surfside tragedy by heading to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Adarad, we discussed how different building codes were 40 years ago, but building materials have also changed substantially since then. Tell us about ultra-high performance concrete and how you think it could be incorporated into new building construction.
You're asking an excellent question. Ultra-high performance concrete is a cementitious type material. So it's like concrete, but it has a steel fiber inside of it, very tiny little steel fibers, high strength, and it's very dense. So another way you can make a container out of this material, and you can put a very aggressive chemicals inside of it, and you will not have a problem. And they have used it actually in Europe. And I was traveling in Switzerland, and I saw examples where they had a container covered by this UHPC or ultra high performance concrete, and very aggressive chemical was inside. UHPC, I think strategically, we can use in a building. Now, I should tell you that this material is being used in the bridge quite a bit. It has opened a new horizon in the bridge engineering for us, but it hasn't really found itself into the structural aspect of the buildings. I think strategically, let's say, for example, if there is an area of a building, let's say in the garage area, that we know that it's going to be prone to have a salt water all the time, covering it over with a thin layer in a maybe segment of the column or the floor, I think that will go a long way to protect this building from a corrosion, or balconies even, for example. Let's say this material is so dense that there is a test that I'll just give you the technical rapid chloride permeability according to the standard test that we do. The number that you obtain for this material is in order of 5 coulomb compared to, let's say, 4,000 coulomb for a regular concrete.
So, well, let me ask you, because we're not all structural engineers, but do you believe that buildings older than 40 years old should be retrofitted with this concrete if that becomes a possibility? And how significant of a cost would condo residents be looking at for that kind of investment?
Okay. I think if there is a, for example, if you just conclude that the reason for the cracking is confined to the surface, and there's not extensive corrosion that's going on, if you remove the contaminated concrete, let's say in the basement, so the assumption is that nothing else is going on. It's not a foundation problem. Nothing, is just a corrosion. Then yes, I would use this material to patch the column, and that will make sure that it is not gonna have. Then you don't have to worry about the maintenance, not the cost. The cost right now, actually, over the last couple of years, there has been more company providing this material. This material, but say 6-7 years ago, was very expensive, in order of probably 20 times more. The company that was marketing it, probably 20 times more expensive than the regular concrete. But now there is a non-proprietary version of this concrete. And at FIU, actually, among some other universities, we have developed a non-proprietary version of this concrete. And if anybody wants the recipe, we will be more than happy to give them the recipe. And that brings the cost significantly down. And it's only maybe three times more expensive than regular concrete, but you don't have to use a very large volume of it. Okay, that's the key.
And I wish we could talk about that even more. That sounds really cool. But we've got about a minute left here. I did want to ask you quickly, you know, beyond retrofitted buildings, you believe that we need to reconfigure the inspection process for older condos beyond the inspectors hired by municipalities. What changes do you believe should be incorporated into the process?
I think we need to develop an inspection system. There has to be check and balances. I think we need to pay the inspector enough so that they can spend sufficient amount of time so they can do a better job in inspection. I think we need to provide them more guidelines. They need to not to say that there is a cracking. They need to say what the cause of the cracking is. And then there has to be a follow-up just to making sure that those retrofit are done, are accomplished on time. So there, I think, and the city people will be the best people to do that. And I think that's why I say we need an inspection system, not just requiring that the building should be inspected. And that inspection system involves check and balances at several stages.
I've been speaking with Adarad Azizi Namini, director of the Moss School of Construction, Infrastructure, and Sustainability at FIU. Professor Azizi Namini, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Still to come, Florida's vaccination rates are lagging while cases are rising. How is the Delta variant spreading in the Sunshine State? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. This past holiday weekend, large gatherings were back for many people. Masks were less visible, too. It might have felt like the first quote-unquote normal summer celebration in a post-pandemic world, but health experts say that's the problem. The pandemic isn't over yet. In Florida, vaccination rates are lagging and COVID-19 cases are rising. Dr. Aileen Marty from Florida International University joins us now. She's an infectious disease expert, and she's on the Miami-Dade County COVID-19 Task Force. Dr. Marty, help us get our bearings for a moment. Where does Florida and South Florida stand in this pandemic?
Well, we're in the middle in terms of all the states and how we're doing in just about everything. We have had an outrageous amount of variants ever since variants were detected in the United States. The data that's coming in right now is our case numbers are going up, and there's quite a significant percentage of those cases are that B.1.617.2, which is the Delta variant. There's actually three forms of the Delta variant, and the one that we're seeing primarily is the original form of the Delta variant, although there is another form, a Delta Plus, that we're also seeing here in Florida.
Oh my goodness. Is it harder for you to keep track now that the Florida Department of Health is not releasing daily reports anymore?
Yes, and also the Center for Disease Control is not, even though the state of Florida is reporting daily to the Center for Disease Control, while they don't report it to the, you know, to the general public, the CDC is not compiling that data on a daily or a weekly basis either. So that it does make it harder to retrieve the information, but I'm very fortunate that I have good friends at the CDC and can get, you know, a little bit of insight as to what's happening.
Well, we're seeing vaccination rates statewide in Florida start to slow down. 54% of Floridians have at least one shot. That is a far cry from the 70% of all Americans that President Joe Biden wanted to have vaccinated by July 4th. What are you seeing that's holding Floridians back?
Well, it's certainly not the availability, because we've done a very good job of making sure that that people can have access to the vaccine. So it's fear. It's a misunderstanding and fear. And also, you know, I think people need to understand the huge difference between getting infected and getting a vaccine. And may I talk about that for a minute?
Of course. Go ahead.
Well, okay. So first of all, if you get the wild virus, you do have a risk of real disease, and that disease can be severe, and it can, in less common instances, it can kill you. All right. That's one aspect. And the second aspect is that even among the people who do not experience severe disease, we're seeing as many as 19% months later showing up with long COVID symptoms, some kind of secondary complication, because they were, even though they had no symptoms when they initially were infected with the SARS-2 virus. That's very important. And of course, it's even worse if you were hospitalized or did have symptoms. The next thing that people have to consider is, how does the immune system work when you're infected with the virus in comparison to how it works when you get the vaccine? When you're infected with the virus, there are different populations of cells called B cells. They're a type of lymphocyte. And some of these B cells are kind of fast acting, which is what you do when your body is confronted with something really scary to the body, like the wild virus. Those types of B cells are not going to give you long-lasting immunity. They will give you both IgM and IgG antibodies, but they're not the highest quality antibodies. They may bind, but they don't bind well, and they don't last. When you get the vaccine, however, then your body sees something that looks bad, and it wants to make a good product against it, and it takes its sweet time, and it forms a completely different type of B cell that actually makes genetic changes to the B cell. We call this somatic hypermutation. So those B cells are super good, and they're long-lasting, and they may last for years in your body. That doesn't happen, and there have been studies back with SARS-1 showing that people completely lost all the memory types of B cells that you need to combat SARS-1 a few years after having been exposed to the disease, that SARS disease. And that's true of almost every single coronavirus. So you see there's a big, big difference as to whether you get infected and whether you have long-lasting immunity or good quality immunity as opposed to getting the vaccine.
So you're likely to have longer lasting, stronger antibodies if you get the vaccine as opposed to if you've just recovered from having COVID.
Exactly. So those antibodies that you get from the vaccine are the antibodies that are made when you're given your sweet time to make the right best type of B cell that actually makes those genetic changes and they sit around and wait for this for the actual viral attack, and they're ready for it. It's kind of like the difference is if there's a hurricane coming, right, and you just find out about it an hour before it's going to show up. Well, the fixes you can do your house are minimal, and they're not that great, and you might actually suffer a significant loss from that storm. But if you're given a warning and you're given equipment and you can, you know, fix your house and put the shutters up and all that, then your chances of riding out your house surviving that storm are a lot better. You see, and that's the difference between experiencing that wild virus by your immune system or taking the vaccine.
I like that analogy. And I want to ask you, because while vaccinations are slowing here, the number of cases for COVID are going up. And Florida has seen more than 10,000 cases in the last 7 days, according to the CDC. But who are we seeing get the virus now, and how sick are people getting?
Mainly, it's the people who have not been vaccinated, and more often than not, it's younger individuals. But that will shift again. We always see it first in the, always is kind of a funny thing to say about a disease that's relatively new, but we generally see this happening in young people first, and then it starts to pop up in the older individuals. And there's been a decline in deaths worldwide, but again, there's been an increase in cases worldwide, and that's why that's part of the problem.
I'm speaking with Dr. Eileen Marty from FIU. She's an infectious disease expert, and she's on the Miami-Dade County COVID-19 Task Force. She's speaking with us about how vaccination rates in Florida are slowing, and cases, well, they're creeping up. You can find more of the latest on COVID-19 in South Florida on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Marty, I want to talk to you about kids for a second, because the virus is still spreading in children under 12 years old. They're the only group that can't get vaccinated yet. How should parents be thinking about summer activities for their kids and going back to in-person schooling in the fall?
Well, I think that's such an important question, in part because it speaks to our remaining vigilant, right? Which is one of the key things you want to make sure your children understand as well, especially since they can't get vaccinated, is if another child is manifesting any type of illness, you know, wash your hands, go somewhere else, make sure you're safe, and be aware that you can get infected. And remember, the dose makes the poison. That was Paracelsus many hundreds of years ago said that. And it's very, very true of this infection. If you get exposed to a very high bolus of virus, you're much more likely to manifest disease. And the bigger that bolus per unit time, the more likely that disease will be more difficult for your body to handle. So,
well, do we have a timeline for when children might be able to get the vaccine?
Oh, yeah, there's actually great news on that front. First of all, It's been many months now, back in March, that Moderna, and even before that, Pfizer, started doing studies on children as young as 6 months. And we're anticipating that we'll have the results of all those studies within the next few weeks, actually. And that therefore we may be able to extend vaccines even before school starts.
Well, unlike the original strain of the virus, we know now that the Delta variant spreads mostly through adolescents and children. I wanted to know, do we know how much the vaccines are effective against the Delta? And you talked a little bit earlier about the Delta Plus, which I'd like to hear some more about.
Yeah, that's really good and very challenging question. So there have been a few studies in the UK, so in England, really, another study in Scotland, another study in Israel, trying to assess exactly what is the vaccine efficacy when you're dealing with these Delta variants. And it really ranges. So the study from from England showed that if you only had one dose of a vaccine, such as the AstraZeneca or one dose of Pfizer, the efficacy had dropped down to 33%, which is very, which is really subpar, not really what we want. And it went back up if you got the second dose, but in the case of Pfizer, it only went up to about 88% in that particular study. In the Scottish study with two doses of Pfizer, you were about 87% against the Delta variant. But unfortunately, in the Israeli study, it was down to about 64-65% for symptomatic disease, but as good as 94-95% against serious disease or death. So that's why you keep hearing it's still effective. Well, yes, it's still effective, but the D is making it more challenging. And so we're on top of that, and the vaccine companies are on top of it. And so there's a plan now to modify the vaccine and see if it can capture the differences, and at which point we could do even better. But one thing that's very important to realize is that these efficacies, while they're not as wonderful as the original efficacy against the original SARS-2 virus, is still infinitely better than not being vaccinated, and far, 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 far better than what happens if you get the wild virus.
Is there a timeline on booster shots for people that are fully vaccinated, or are we a ways away from that still?
Well, the real problem is those of us who have had the vaccine have a good amount of protection, a good solid amount of protection. But the world as a whole still has a very low vaccination rate. And so long as the vaccination rate is low, either in a pocket of the United States where we are seeing rising cases in those under vaccinated, 30% vaccinated rate locations in the United States, or Africa, or wherever the people are under vaccinated, as long as that's circulating, you have the possibility of forming another worse variant. And we might go, we talk about variants of interest, we talk about variants of concern, and we're very worried about a variant of high impact, which would be one where the vaccines and the meds that we're using no longer function. And so it still remains very important that we use as many public health measures as is reasonable in order to reduce the transmission. So it's still a good idea to not cluster in places where there are a lot of people that are indoors and that are poorly ventilated, especially if those other individuals are people that are strangers and you don't know their vaccine status. In those situations, it's better to mask up.
Well, Dr. Marty, I could ask you questions about this all day. Unfortunately for time, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure.
I've been speaking with infectious disease expert at FIU, Dr. Eileen Marty. You can read more of our coverage on the coronavirus pandemic by going to our website at wlrn.org/coronavirus. And that's Sundial for Wednesday, July 7th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we learn more about the political crisis in Haiti following the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. We also learn about the reaction from the large Haitian diaspora living in South Florida. Plus, millions of dollars have been raised for the survivors of the Surfside condo collapse and the family members of victims. How all that money will be spent and what resources are still needed remain critical questions. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.